highest level of inequality is occurring in cities. And people are moving into a city in order to have access to a market. However, the access to a market is unequal based on the accessibility of affordable public transport. So a lack of connections is going to inhibit your upward mobility.
Inequality and climate change are two of the most pressing issues of our time, with repercussions lasting long into the future. Tariq Guptu and Lindsay Walsh are both graduate students and both of a generation that is highly motivated to bridge income gaps and stop global warming.
And inherently, it's a problem of the wealthy overconsuming. And we're basically, in the future, going to see this problem of climate apartheid, where if you can pay to save yourself, you will be able to save yourself. So, a lot of us have a responsibility living in these countries that have long benefited at the expense of other countries to use our privilege to talk about this and get it on the agenda.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. In December 2018, Finance and Development magazine launched an essay competition calling for graduate students worldwide to submit their thoughts on how they would tackle inequality. Essays came in from more than two dozen countries. And in today's program, IMF chief economist Geeta Gopinath sits down with the two winners before a live audience to chat about their essays.
Welcome to all of you in the studio and those online. Today, we have with us Lindsay Walsh, who is a graduate in natural sciences from Trinity College Dublin, where she's studying for a master's in development practice, and Tariq Guptu, who just finished his master's of philosophy in economics from Oxford University. So Lindsay, let me just jump in and let me start with you. Climate change is a very important topic for us, and consistent with one of the main points in your essay is that we also do find in our research that climate change affects the lowest income people most severely. Now, when people think about the impact of climate change, it's not that they automatically think about inequality, and that's what's really clever about your essay, is you make that connection. So can you tell us something about what made you make that connection? How do you see that connection?
Well, I think it's interesting because the way the media has presented climate change to us, I mean, at first it was very much a conservation issue and, you know, the image of polar bears on melting sea ice. And then it became an environmental issue and governments kind of started to take notice of it, but it was like something for environmentalists to deal with, you know, over there, as if the environment doesn't encapsulate everything and we live within it, obviously. And now I think people are beginning to realize that climate change is going to impact every single aspect of our lives. I mean, sea level rise, drought, famine, climate migrants, conflict, disease, like the list goes on. And all of these things I just mentioned, they're going to impact low-income countries by far the most. Yet they contributed least to this problem. I mean, the US and the EU contributed around 50% of cumulative greenhouse gas emissions. And like the entire continent of Africa has contributed less than 4%. Like the difference is there. Yet the continent of Africa is already witnessing the impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. And inherently it's a problem of the wealthy overconsuming. So, top 10% wealthiest people in the world have contributed 50% of emissions. I mean, that number is staggering, I think. And it's the same, it's between countries and it's also within countries. I mean, even here in the US, Black and Hispanic communities are far more likely to experience air pollution than white communities. So across the board, it's going to affect those least well off and those least able to defend and least able to adapt afterwards and rebuild. And I mean, everyone's going to be impacted, but it's going to be the poorest who are going to be the first hit and the worst hit. And we're basically, in the future, going to see this problem of climate apartheid, where mm-hmm. if you can pay to save yourself, you will be able to save yourself. And I think that is just the biggest issue of inequality and of crisis that we're currently facing.
No, I think, I mean, that's, that's a great point that you make, and it's not going away anytime soon. And unfortunately, there are not very many easy fixes, but it is a medium, long-run problem that we just have to deal with. Tariq, let me come to you. You look at this problem of inequality through a completely different lens, which is a focus on urbanization. So can you tell us about how, you know, the design of cities can help or hinder convergence and lower inequality?
Sure, yeah. So I guess to explain a bit how I drew the connection at first, we live in a world of accelerating and increasing urbanization. We have around 55% of the global population living in cities today, and that's expected to increase to 68%. So that's 2 out of 3 people. Not only that, but we're seeing that this is most prevalent and the rates are the highest among the emerging economies. So this isn't just a matter of this is a rich country's problem, this is a poor country's problem, this is every country's problem. So I kind of wanted to turn my lens a little bit more towards within country inequality. And if everyone is moving into cities, what's currently going on in cities? And what I found was that what a lot of research shows is that the highest level of inequality is occurring in cities. So cities have become a locus for the most severe inequality that we see today, partially because cities are drawing people from the highest and lowest sections of the income distribution, but it's disproportionately awarding people who are wealthier. So what I wanted to do was look at the mechanisms as to why this is occurring in cities. So if a ton of people are moving into cities and cities are very unequal, what's going on? And I wanted to highlight the role of transportation and all of that. So if you think about it, transportation is not something that we really think about too much, but it's something that we do all the time. Now, transportation leads us to our jobs. If we take transportation infrastructure, whether it's roads, trains, bridges, ferries, what have you, to our jobs, our kids' schools, groceries for food, very important services in the city. And people are moving into a city in order to have access to a market. However, the access to a market within the city is unequal based on the accessibility of affordable public transport. If you look at it this way, good transportation allows you better access and quicker access to your jobs, to your schools, to important services. However, a lack of connections or a misallocation of connections based on taking you places to where you're not planning on going anyway, that's going to inhibit your upward mobility. It limits the scope within the city in which you can apply for jobs or search for jobs. Reaching services, creating food deserts, for example, it's hard for you to reach groceries. And it just hinders your overall productivity, not having access to the entire market that the city has to offer. So if we want to be able to welcome people into cities and really bring out the most productivity and upward mobility out of people who are moving in the developing world and the developed world, we need to focus on leveraging data to figure out where people are and demographic patterns of urban expansion, so we can better plan limited transportation budgets to really get the most bang for your buck when you're planning transportation infrastructure.
No, that's great. I mean, one of the issues that we've been emphasizing recently is about the need for some countries to invest more in their infrastructure. And as you point out, this is not just an issue about overall growth, but it's also an issue about inequality, and better public transportation, for instance, can improve that. So let me just move on to a couple of questions that were posed submitted online. So the first question is, it's clearly the case that young people care a lot about this issue of inequality, and so why is that? And then the second question is that, what should governments do to tackle this inequality? Lindsay, would you like to go first?
Okay, well, coming from a climate change perspective, I suppose, I think that our generation is realizing that a lot of the factors that are destroying the planet are also, like, such as relentless pursuit of profit and deregulation, are also negatively impacting our lives. So causing inequality, first of all, yes, but also breaking down social cohesion and weakening of institutions as well. And I don't think that we have this romantic idea that the market can fix it all. And secondly, I think that the youth of today are generally quite compassionate. I think we have a different set of values, different set of kind of goals to work towards. A lot of people going into the workforce now don't want to just climb the corporate ladder and make a lot of money. A lot of people I talk to, they want to create some social good as well. And I think we've kind of realized that this, the bottom line being the be-all and end-all, doesn't make people very happy, and it doesn't make societies very happy. And then with climate change particularly, I think that very few people in positions of power have really stepped up to the plate and talked about this and like really done something about it. And so I think the youth have had to move and kind of lead to the leadership positions.
So and so, what should the government do about tackling inequality? You don't need to, it's a difficult question. You certainly don't need to have the answers to it. But if you have any thoughts
for government, I think there's a lot private and public sector can do. So carbon taxes, yes, which I know the IMF are very in favor of, and yes, they're very good, but they're just one tool that needs to be used. I think when Nordhaus proposed them, and if they'd been implemented back then, they would have worked very well. But that was a long time ago. I think the boat on gradual change has like well and truly sailed at this point. Maybe if we'd implemented them 30 years ago, they would have worked well. But we also need governments to stop issuing licenses for coal, oil, gas exploration. We need fee baits, whereby you know the polluter pays principle, whereby polluting industries are taxed highly and rebates are given to green energy. And there's a lot of speak of the Green New Deal in the United States of America. Perhaps an international Green New Deal would be better, in which lots of different countries, all countries, come together and create a system whereby all of them are phasing out fossil fuels and implementing renewables. So governments need to come together. We need multilateralism, and we need an international climate fund that's purely dedicated to help vulnerable countries prepare and also to provide relief afterwards. And this would be largely funded by high-income countries. But I think it should be headed by persons from these low-income countries, like where it's going to be needed most, so that they can choose their own path to a green future, essentially. Because the truth is, a lot of people in positions of power today, they're not going to be alive to see the true devastating impacts of climate change. It's going to be far down the line. But I think those people really need to look at themselves and think about what legacy they want to leave personally and what legacy they want to leave for their institutions as well. Because there's two paths we can currently take right now. It's we can continue on business as usual and not upsetting the status quo, and people will pay for it with their lives, or we can truly step up to the plate now, and we can finally prioritize long-term well-being over short-term profits.
So even for people who care, maybe are not going to be around, and maybe who don't care about their legacy, but if they care about being re-elected, and if there are enough people who care about this issue, it can become a short-term issue for them too. Absolutely. So I think that sets the case. Tariq?
Yeah, very much so. So I guess to start with why my generation is into this problem is, I would say that youth unemployment and youth mobility into cities, or youth migration into cities, are both very salient issues, in which once this essay came out and I started talking to it about people, especially my peers, they started to talk about how their personal experiences, and a lot of, and if you think about it, the youth are the people who have the most capacity for upward mobility. Those are the people who typically have advanced degrees and are coming in looking for work in cities. However, city living costs are going up because the lack of public infrastructure in cities has naturally made places with the best services and with the best assets in it, so jobs and such, very high rents. So as a result, people, the youth who are moving into cities can't necessarily afford those places to live in. And if they don't move into an area with affordable, sustainable public transport, they do not have equal access to those markets, inhibiting their upward mobility. So this is kind of where the government would come in. Because if urbanization runs uncontrolled and public transport does not match the needs of where people need to go, you're just looking at a collection of suburbs, some communities doing better than others. And that's not something that will sustain a long-term growth strategy for a lot of these countries, perpetuating spatial inequality. So I think what the government can really do is they know they're short on funds, but they also know that they have, or most governments are short on funds to do everything they would like to do. But they also have an electoral mandate to make sure that they're maximizing mobility in a city. So I think the main thing that they can do is leverage data on the demographics of urban expansion so they can really draw a little bit more certainty on where communities need to go and what kind of services they need to be connected to, so they can better, more efficiently plan their limited budgets. Also, drawing more certainty using data mm-hmm. actually makes the private sector more comfortable with public-private partnerships, because infrastructure as a whole is a very uncertain investment. You're not necessarily sure once you build something, what's the utilization going to be. So the private sector is very worried about their return on investment. However, if intermediaries like the IMF, World Bank, so on, maybe some consultancies and other partners work between the government, help coordinate the efforts between the government and the private sector to really make well thought out, well funded projects that are targeting the right places, that can really make a huge difference in kind of making cities from a vehicle of economic divergence to a vehicle of economic convergence.
No, that's great. I like your specificity in taking into account the practical challenges and the need that there will be public-private partnerships and how that can be made more attractive by having a more scientific, data-driven approach over here. So I think with that, we don't have time for more discussion. I think this was really great. The two things I will take away, one is I liked very much, Lindsay, your point about an international climate fund and an international green New Deal. I think there's a deeper concept there, which I really like. And Tariq, your idea about green public transportation for reducing inequality within urban areas, I think was very, very salient. Are you guys pessimists or optimists in this? Just one word each.
I'd say I'm an optimist.
Optimist, yeah.
Okay, great. Wonderful. Lindsay and Tariq, thank you for joining us. And more importantly, congratulations on winning the essay competition.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That was IMF Chief Economist Geeta Gopinath speaking with graduate students Lindsay Walsh and Tariq Guptu about their essays on inequality published in the December 2019 edition of Finance and Development magazine. You can read their essays online at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app to read them on your mobile device. Look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you like what you're hearing. And follow us on Twitter @IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.